Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far, and the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM with our live studio audience.
Woohoo!
Settle down. This February 16th, 2016 edition, episode 77 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. We are joined today by Doug Peacock, who is calling in from southern Arizona. We'll be taking calls this week. If you have any questions for our guest or for ourselves, please give us a call toll-free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Doug Peacock is a legend. He served two tours in Vietnam as a Green Beret medic, trying to preserve life on the edge of the battlefield. He came home an emotional and spiritual wreck. With the publication of Edward Abbey's The Monkey Wrench Gang in 1975, Peacock became a hero not only to other veterans, but to a nascent contingent of environmentalists. The hero, depending on your views of fiction and reality, was either George Washington Hayduke, the novel's archetypal monkey wrencher, or Abbey's model for Hayduke, his friend, Doug Peacock. Peacock is a prolific writer. He lectures regularly about wilderness and veterans issues. He was the subject of a feature film about grizzlies and Vietnam called Peacock's War. The film premiered on PBS Nature and won the grand prizes at the Telluride Mountain Film and the Snowbird Film Festivals. American author Terry Tempest Williams describes Peacock as a humble warrior, fearless and honest, with a heart as big as the wild country he loves. American writer and Peacock's Montana neighbor Peter Bowen says the only way to stop Peacock is to cut his head off and bury it where he can't find it. You can find more about Doug and read more about him on his website, DougPeacock.net. Thank you for joining us, Doug, on Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, thank you.
Guy just recently introduced me to your writing, and I'm reading your book, Walking It Off, and I was wondering if you could begin to talk a little bit about the walking that you do and the hiking you do in the wilderness and what it's done for your life.
Well, walking across a wild landscape, carrying a backpack, it really doesn't matter where you are, but it's the quickest exit I know from my own culture, my own society, and I often had to remove myself from such settings. One of my favorite hikes was down here in southern Arizona. Every winter I used to hike across Cabeza Prieta alone from end to end, sometimes 140 miles, sometimes 150 or, 20, depending on which way you go. And there's, nobody out there. And if you don't, there's stretches of 45 miles with no water. And if you don't know where the water is and find it, you die. But on the other hand, after 3 or 4 days out, you reach it. you reach a place within yourself that you just rarely see anymore. And it takes the same thing happens to me up in grizzly country, where I'll hike up to a mountain and spend a week with grizzly bears. I used to film them and photograph them, but I stopped all that, 20 years ago. I just figured I was bugging the bears a little bit more than I needed to bug, so I quit it. But, walking is not quite a literal metaphor. It's actually something a lot more real in my life. You go out, the only things I know what to do when I get, for instance, the winter blues, is to get outside in the wildest place I can find in nature and walk around, get some exercise, and reconnect with the things around you. Right now, down in southern Arizona, the birds are singing mating songs a couple weeks early. I don't know what that means.
Well, it seems to me that most people, they don't see or they can't comprehend the fact that they can learn something from the planet that they walk upon. And in your writing, you seem to stress that, the things that you're learning while you're out there.
Yeah, you need to pry yourself open. I'm not really a good example of that because I just lucked out. When I came back from Vietnam, I was like thousands of other vets. I was out of sorts. I couldn't be around people. So I went to one place where I've always been comfortable, and that's the wilderness. I was raised by a dad who was a Boy Scout organizer, and he used to take me to Boy Scout camps where I was too little to be a Boy Scout, but I got cut out to run around the woods and look for turtles and fish for bluegills and things like that. So that's what I did. And I happened to run into grizzly bears. I wasn't looking for them, but I ran into them. And, the grizzly bear we can talk a lot about this, but, with a grizzly bear, the last thing you can do in grizzly country is really think about yourself. You're out there with something bigger and stronger than you, then if it wants to, it can, kill and eat your ass off. And that, that means you really can't be too nonchalant. You really got to pay attention. And you got to pay attention to the things around you, because the last thing you want to do is come eyeball to eyeball with a couple of big grizzlies at too close a range. And so, what I do when I'm in bear country, but pretty much everywhere in the wilderness, I don't walk fast. I move through the landscape like another animal. And I don't use trails or things like that. I bushwhack. And, that bushwhack is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for being off the trail and seeing anew. Because when in grizzly country, you really got to smell better, hear better, see more things than you ever need to. You can also you can put on your Kelty pack and tromp down any trail in California or Colorado, say, with a head full of acid, thinking about your portfolio or your girlfriend, and it really doesn't matter. But you can't do that in grizzly country. And, I called it an enforced humility. But that's what the bear brings upon you. Self-indulgence is utterly impossible in grizzly country. And to keep yourself upright in more ways than one, you've really got to open your senses. And that's when I'm most alive, most vital. And it's nothing beyond the reach of anybody. I have a friend who can find humility before nature in his backyard watching ants. Me, I have to have these huge expanses of tundra and such, with big, dangerous animals on them.
So you understand the concept of habitat better than any PhD-possessing climate scientist I know. As human animals, we require habitat to survive. So let's talk about grizzlies and wolverine a little bit. So we talk about the impacts of climate change, as you've seen them, on habitat for those top of the food chain predators, grizzlies and wolverines, at least in the lower 48.
Okay. Well, let's just take the wolverine, for example, because the wolverine south of Canada, along with the polar bear worldwide, is probably going to be the first large predator to sniff out. And in the Northern Rockies, mainly where I live, in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and a few other states, we have maybe 250 wolverines left south of Canada. A wolverine needs what they call persistent spring snowpack. And that means where the snow lingers from, they've really pinned this one down. This is really good science. They pinned it down between April 24th and May 15th, where the snow is. And 100% of the reproductive activity, they're denning, they're having pups, happens in this snow. They den in the snow. It's essential for raising their young. And, you know, it's their habitat is almost that simple. You know, the habitat is, the critical habitat for the wolverine south of Canada is this persistent snowpack. They need it. Now, that's one of the easiest things to monitor on Earth. You can just take a satellite picture and see where, you know, where the snow is every year. And, you know, for instance, up in Glacier Park, where I was a fire lookout, grossly overpaid at $4 an hour, not a very good one at that. You know, that's where the densest population of wolverines is. And up there, they're monitoring the glaciers really carefully. And just in my miserable lifetime, I mean, you know, I've been up there, 40 years max? And I've watched the glaciers go from glaciers to snowfields, from snowfields to bare ground. And the last glacier in Glacier National Park will be gone by the end of this decade. And so, you know, that's reflected also upon the snowpack. So this is pretty, I think, as far as listing an endangered animal, at least it's threatened under the Endangered Species Act, about as simple as it gets. Here's an animal facing global warming in a measurable habitat that involves snow, which can be monitored many different ways. And we tried to list that, and all the government scientists, they went out, and, you know, indeed, it doesn't take a weatherman to figure this sucker out. Is, you know, those wolverines are going under, and they're going under really fast. And so it was one of those rare things where independent biologists and government biologists all agreed that, you know, the wolverine needs some protection. And so it went from, you know, from government biologists and independent scientists to the regional director of the Federal Wildlife Service in Denver. And Noreen Walsh is a regional director, and she rejected the findings of her own field scientists, saying that the global, basically, global warming and models of global warming, you know, they're not proven. She totally denies it. And I'll talk about grizzlies in a minute, but we've really got a problem. You know, a lot of us people are kind of like critters and such. You know, a lot of us voted for Obama. We really thought he'd do something. Well, the son of a bitch, you know, the Federal Wildlife Service is not the friend of large animals. And he's done nothing. You know, his Department of Interior, especially the Federal Wildlife Service that administers my bears and other thing else, you know, has just been lousy. They fought every effort we can. You know, we tried to protect the grizz, buffalo, wolverines, wolves, and we just had our ass kicked by these bureaucrats that Obama stuck in there. And, you know, it's getting late in his regime. I'd like to see a little payback here. let me leave it at that, because I can talk about grizzlies for a long time. And if you want me to, just ask me. But go ahead.
Well, that, you know, it seems to me it's the system. The direct action approach described by Abby and perhaps practiced by you dramatically influenced American grassroots groups like Earth First and ALF. Both groups were deemed homegrown eco-terrorists by the Bush administration. So what do you think about that? What do you think about that approach? What do you think about the designation by the Bush administration? What do you think about that kind of action today in light of what you just described, a completely ineffective federal government?
Yeah, and one thing that you just noticed throughout the decades is, you know, when these guys got 9/11, went after all the terrorists in the world, what did they do? You know, they didn't bust a single terrorist. They came up with ELF, and that's pretty lightweight, you know. And these poor groups of eco-terrorists, whatever you want to call them, you know, they've been trashed for no good reason. And Earth First itself was a oh, you know, it's, there's problems with everybody. But, you know, that was a direct, you can really attribute the Earth's first, the origins go right back to Ed Abbey and the Monkey Wrench Game, as simple as that. And, you know, what they did is they really broadened the dialogue a lot. You know, the direct actions, the point is, Abbey's point in writing the Monkey Wrench Game was, and I was with him all that time, is to, and actually, Abbey socialized me a lot. You know, I was a great fan of bunnies and bears and stuff like that. But, you know, we really needed more allies than what we saw in the rather lonely fight for the wilderness, you know, where we monkey wrench and such. And he wrote that book hoping that little cells of monkey wrenchers would pop up all over the place. And it was partially successful, but, you know, it's even more important today. And civil disobedience is not just an option. It's almost a duty in our world. I mean, it's so screwed on so many levels. And, you know, you've got to put your foot down and take some responsibility and go and do what you think is right. I mean, what's legal is not always right, and vice versa. And monkey wrenching and civil disobedience should be high priorities, especially for any young person looking around his world or her world today. What else were we talking about?
Is there anything else to talk about? Your idea for a latter-day salvage job, those are your words, for the planet is big wilderness, places where creatures and plants can survive and perhaps even evolve. To that end, you co-founded Round River Conservation Studies a quarter century ago, and you still serve as chairman of the board for that organization. Since its founding, working with indigenous people, Round River has preserved about 25 million acres of wild habitat. So let's talk about Round River Conservation Studies. What's going on with them right now?
Okay, well, Round River was a homegrown conservation organization that has student programs. You know, it was designed to serve those students, but it started back here in Tucson in 1991 when my friend Dennis Sizemore, he didn't know me then, but he showed up at my house with a ice chest full of antelope tenderloin and a bottle of George Jickel. Back then, that's what I considered good manners, you know? And,
what do you mean back then?
Well, yeah. Anyway, that's the way we met people. That's Ed Abbey very shyly with a bottle of gin, you know, knocking at Bill Eastlake's door in Tibucani, New Mexico. You know, that was, and when Abbey and I got together here in Tucson, right after I got back in Vietnam, over at Bill Eastlake's house, and so I went to visit him, you know, down in Oregon Pipe, where he was a seasonal ranger. And again, I had a bottle of whiskey and a six-pack under my arm when I knocked at the Quonset Hut door down in Ajo. But anyway, Round River, it started out as a pretty small project. And it was funded initially by my friends, Doug Tompkins, who we said goodbye to a couple months ago. He died down in a kayak accident down in Chile. And Yvonne Chouinard, you know, that's Patagonia and the Foundation for Deep Ecology. But, you know, we I don't even remember what the hell we did that first year. But anyway, you know, we stuck students out someplace doing, the idea is upperclassmen students would go out in the field and do real work, you know, not just mess around, not just screw around, but do real work and eventually for real people. And so we started partnering with Native Americans. You know, we had a long-time standing project up with the Halsuk band up on, the central coast of British Columbia, and another one way inland, way up the Taku River of British Columbia, almost to the Yukon, with the Taku River Tlingit. And that thing started 20 years ago, and you know and it's a matter of going up and first of all finding that you have interest in mine. I mean, the native people up there had their traditional territories. They were interested in saving habitat, like wildlife habitat, not for development, but for, you know, the conservation of habitat, and also, you know, for traditional uses, which are always almost without exception, they're non-mechanized. And, you know, with that common objective, let me just take the case of the Tlinga, way up river. And, this is the forest that starts with a rainforest way down at the bottom. The Taku River actually dumps into Alaska, into the Pacific, just south of Juneau a little bit. But, there's 15 million acres upstream. So Round River went in there with their student programs. And, they immediately partnered with the traditional Tlingit people. And that band wasn't very, there's only 400 or 500 people at that time. So that's a small area with a big responsibility. And 20 years ago, just the difference today is amazing. These were people who are products of the missionary system and boarding schools. And, the common but terrible racism of our time, where we take people out of their homes and try to strip them of their culture and language. And they, they hadn't said no to a white man in recent history. Well, that's all changed today. They ended up with Round River's help and partnership. We went out and surveyed all these lands, did all the, dot your I's and cross your T's type wildlife surveys and traditional use patterns and stuff like that. And finally went to the, it finally got to be government-to-government negotiations with the Taku River Tlingit Nation and British Columbia. And when the ink dried, about 10 million acres went into, I wouldn't say quite instant wilderness, but 8 of it did, and there's 2 million more. Now it's land where, you'll never have a clear cut, a road, anything but traditional use. And, that's 4 or 5 Yellowstone parks. It's a big chunk of land. And that would not happen without Round River conservation studies going up. And I serve as the board chairman, but I really don't have much to do with running. But my guidelines are, they're pretty idiot-proof. You tell the truth and you keep your promises. And, with Native people especially, that's the way to go. And so there's Round River also has programs in Botswana and Namibia, in Patagonia, down in Chile. And, they worked with the National Monument proposed for Cedar Mesa, which is Bear's Ears. That was started with Round River working with Navajo elders. And now it's before the president. I hope he signs it over. It's 1.9 million acres. And, it's not just the most beautiful slick rock country you ever saw, but it has more archaeological features per unit of surface land than anything outside of the Valley of Mexico and this continent. So it's and beautiful petroglyphs, good firewood. You should go there. Okay. Round River has done these things, and they're a very small group. They don't blow their horn, and they've been funded variously throughout the years for the programs, like the Pew Foundation, Brainerd, the Gordon Moore Foundation. In large part, they get student tuition fees, and they run the program off that. Let me just take a minute, because the most important unfunded Round River conservation studies project is going on right now. And right now, and exactly what that is Round River has been asked by the Inuit to live up in the north slope of the Yukon to partner with them to extend a large national park. This is the ostensible reason. A large national park, which sits on the Beaufort Sea adjacent to Alaska and runs east towards the Mackenzie River. Well, it was originally made a national park for the Inuit. It's a Native American park because of the caribou calving. Well, and because of global warming, the caribou calving has shifted eastward towards the Mackenzie River. And so this the doubling of this national park, which altogether I think is about 6 million acres, would extend the national park eastward to the Mackenzie River. You know, that's a very big deal up there. That's, if you look at a blank, you know, look at a map of the earth, and it's one of the big dark areas you're going to see, because there's not, in all of this area, there's not a permanent village, there's not a road. And there's no place on earth where global warming is going on more, you know, so more palpably, faster and more visible. And so I'm trying, right now Ron River is meeting with a Trudeau government in Ottawa to try to get them to help fund it. And, you know, and this partnership has already got a signed contract between Ron River and it's called the Yukon North Slope Conservation Initiative. You know, that's a Native American organization that represents all the Inuits that live up there. And this place is, you know, just like I said, I have not been up there in decades, but, you know, the reports we get from up there, this is, for me, would be the epicenter for observational climate change, abrupt climate change. I have pictures sent to me, you know, in the last few years, we've been really trying to get this rolling. But everybody knows what's happening to the summer sea ice. It's gone. That's the Beaufort Sea. You know, and you look at a map, see where Alaska is. The Beaufort Sea sort of slopes up to the northwest at that point. But, you know, these are traditional people. They hunt caribous and marine mammals. There isn't any ice in the late summer up there. And the permafrost is rapidly thawing. It's caving off on the beaches. I've been sent pictures. Caving off along the riverbank. It's on fire some places. I've got a picture of a pond boiling with methane. And that's happening right now. Now, I said there's not a village in this area, but there's seasonal caribou hunters. They noted as of several years ago that the ocean was rising. And again, traditional knowledge, you know, beats Western science of the punch. That hadn't even been documented up there by the Navy, who tends to keep pretty good records. And this is going on, and of course, the terrible things are happening. Polar bears, the last polar bears, are wandering inland because there's no platforms of ice to hunt from. And on going inland to graze, to hunt caribou, they run into grizzly bears who are, for global warming reasons, wandering north. And they interact. We don't know what they do, but we know they have fertile offspring. I mean, the grizzly bear and the polar bear are genetically actually very close. And so they interact, they mate, they have fertile offspring. The polar bear is not going to make it. The way it's going to survive is by folding its genes back into the grizzly bear, you know, because a polar bear evolution came from a brown bear, probably in Russia, who wandered north under the ice and started hunting seals. And you add another 100,000 years, and you got an animal that looks totally different, but genetically is not. And, you know, that's sort of a sad commentary, but that'll be the repository of polar bear genes. It'll be back in the brown bear. This has happened a couple times in prehistory. Of course, we won't be around to witness the next emergence of the polar bear, but with or without, it'll come. So what I'm saying to everybody is we need co-sponsorship. We need funding for this project, and it's just sitting there. And again, the science that Ron River can take care of will satisfy all the government's needs for documentation and other rationale for making this a national park. But at the same time, there's, you know, you just can't, you know, I don't know any place where climate change is so palpable and so rapid, and it's also available for documentation. And my idea is, I really hope Ron River could find a partner to, I would think that climate change scientists just want to jump right in. I mean, above all, we need boots on the ground, not more models, and here's a place to get it. And here's the ticket already punched to get up there and get in it. So If you know any institutions, foundations, scientists, please pass the word along. It's called Round River Conservation Studies. You can do it directly or come through me. And this would be a great project, you know, for everybody.
That's great. You're listening to Nature Bass Last on the Progressive Radio Network. Mike and I are engaged in conversation with American legend Doug Peacock. Let's turn the clock back a bit and talk about Ed Abbey. His writing was very influential for me, starting during my college years. In real life, he influenced you, and you inspired his writing as well. What was that like, and how important is Abbey's work today?
Abbey and I had a friendship, and and the friendship above all was based on our love for the wilderness and the need to really defend it. I didn't really start writing until I was up in Glacier National Park. Ed was always really supportive. He was one of the most supportive writers of other writers I ever knew. But I wouldn't quite, you know, I never really seen myself as a writer. I do things, and a lot of things, and, you know, that experience is usually primary, and when I read it up, the recording is a little bit secondary. You know, today I'm not skipping along the ridge tops quite so much, and the writing really is important. But Ed was completely supportive that way. His, you know, his seminal work he wrote, hell, how long ago was 1968? A long damn time ago, right? And, you know, Desert Solitaire is just stands today. I mean, it is a masterpiece. It stands so well today. I mean, The Monkey Wrench Gang is a great comic novel. It's a hoot. And, you know, I hope somebody, makes a movie out of it someday, although the movie path has not been a very good one so far for the Monkey Wrench Gang. But Desert Solitaire is his, you know, his classic, work. And when it showed up, you know, the world didn't know much about Edward Abbey. You know, they were just a writer who was, you know, he was angry, he was eloquent, he was crude, poetic all at the same time. And, you know, he had this voice that, you know, that stung with garlic, and in the prose it really raced like some kind of rabbit across the desert. So he got people's attention. But, you know, that Desert Solitaire is a book that changed lives back then, and it's changing them still. You know, it's the one thing I keep sticking in front of people, is Desert Solitaire. In that book itself, there are, you know, the terrible beasts that are stalking our human world today, which is, you know, we're still looking out for nukes, and we're looking at global warming. There are hints of all of this in Desert Solitaire. You know, in Desert Solitaire, there's a parable in there you know, it's a child that has an incredible hallucination, and he's left out on the river, and he dies from massive overexposure to, you know, like, radiation. We don't know if it's atomic rays or rays from the sun, but, you know, it's a parable. And Abbey doesn't provide us any easy answers, but, you know, he knew back then, as we should know today, you know, just as we grasp our absolute need for wilderness and the wild beauty of nature, we're losing it. And it's the children that are going to pay the price. Now, Abbey was saying that, you know, 45-some years ago. And didn't anybody who, you know, tried to offend more people, if there's anything anybody he failed to insult, you know, he'd be rolling over in his grave with regret. That's what we need today. Now, when Abbey died, and I was next to him when he died, I buried him 2 days later after I found the correct illegal burial site deep in the desert. What was I saying? Sorry, Matt. I'm looking at the birds out here. I'm in the backyard looking at birds. I really am. There's a ton of them, and a roadrunner just jumped over the fence. Okay, so we're talking about Abbey and, you know, how important he is. Well, you know, when Abbey died, I thought, hell, you know, there'd be lots of writers will jump in and fill those lecherous, you know, toothy shoes of his, those big goddamn shoes. But for whatever reason, nobody really did. And, you know, and therefore his lingering importance today is partly because of that. He was just, you know, he had this cranky humor. And it was most apparent just before he died, because he actually died of blood loss from, you know, it's portal hypertension. But anyway, you know, it's where you put it in your throat, stuff like that. But he had this dark, cranky humor. And he had it all through his life, and it's best evoked in his essays and his novels. Fool's Progress is his last great novel, and it's a much underrated novel. I'd advise anybody to take a look at it. But this Pickup Abbey, you know, if you get angry at something and you get tired of shaking your little gray fist in the air, pick up Ed Abbey, and you'll laugh along with him. Okay.
You know, I couldn't agree more, and I think he's still vastly underrated as an author, as somebody who is describing reality and how he chose to live and rage within that reality. There are two writers I've come across in my life who make me, when I'm reading their work, make me want to put the book down and take a walk, and that's you and him. So I think, if you're looking for a successor to Ed Abbey, I would say we found one.
Well, good luck to me with that. I'm walking inside to pop my first beer of this interview, and by the time I get halfway through the second, we're done. Okay.
Your first. We started long before the show.
Yeah. Hang on just a minute.
Is it a pop top?
There we go. Okay.
All right. In walking it off, you wrote Edward Abbey died so well. So, Doug, what constitutes a good death?
Oh, man.
That's what I do.
Well,
I ask those kind of questions.
You know, yeah. Excuse me. A minute here.
You might want to chug that beer before you answer this.
Yeah. Well, it was the end of the journey, and he knew it. And he went on with, you know, it wasn't the end of life. It was the joy of living, and he went on with incredible dignity. I don't know anybody. I've been around a lot of death in my life, and you know, I haven't accompanied a braver one ever. You know, right at the end, we were in the Tucson Medical Center, and he waited for Ed to die. They took his tough old bastard. Took him almost a week to croak, you know, and he was dying there. But he ripped out all the tubes, all the goddamn tubes and IVs and stuff like that, and he'd sit in there. And I'd go in with his wife, Clark, and Jack Leffler and Steve Prescott, and he looks at me with the clearest goddamn eyes I've ever seen. He said, "Douglas, it's time to go." So we hauled him out of the hospital, and we were going to take him out to die. You know, I was going to take him out not too far from Red Rocks, actually, a really great place out there. But he started to go a little fast, and Clark pulled over to railroad tracks. We had two vehicles, and she said, "Doug, he's going fast. Find another place." So we took Ed out to a place, you know, just a little northwest of Tucson where I used to live, but it's out there. I'm the kind of weird guy that all of a sudden I'll have to go just spend the night, and I'll go camp out someplace, you know, and build a little fire and, you know, drink some beer and just sleep under the stars, you know. And I'm impossible to live with if I don't do that. So I had this little place up there. We took Ed out to it. We got him out. And, you know, put him in a sleeping bag, and he had Clark get in the sleeping bag with him, because he's ready to die, you know. And, I built a little fire for him first, and he sat in a chair around a little mesquite fire, you know, and then he got in a bag with Clark, and, the three of us, me and Steve and Jack Leffler, went over, and we all said goodbye, you know, shook hands and said, "Goodbye, Ed," you know, and, then we went back and waited. And waited a couple hours for him to die. It was getting about dawn then, and I walked back over to him, and I heard him cough. I went over, and he looked up at me and says, "Douglas, sometimes the magic doesn't work."
The movie makes it so much more romantic than you describe it in Walking It Off, I have to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he did die a few days later. And the last time Ed Abbey smiled, this is really important to me, I was alone with him that last night. You know, we were working on shifts, and I had the midnight to morning shift because I'm an old Green Beret medic, and, you know, our other friend was Steve Prescott, who was an MD. But both of us would handle, you know, we had shifts, and it was my shift, and Ed wanted an overdose. He kept asking for an overdose, and, you know, I gave him what I could. But at the very end, he started to fail, and I was about ready to get everybody in there because he was going fat. And he asked me where I was going to bury him, and I told him the name of the place that he knew very well. And that's the last time Ed Abbey ever smiled.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, that was good.
All right. Thanks for that story. Your latest book was about a period of planetary warming and human activity as a formula for extinction. Can you tell us a little bit about your 2013 book, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth?
Yeah, well, I was, you know, the cardinal issue of my time, not surprisingly, is global warming, okay? And that's, you know, this is about, I don't know when I started to write that book. I'd have to look back, but at least 10 years ago, I would think. And, you know, I wanted to talk about global warming in some way that wasn't a complete bummer. Well, we've all had this problem, because indeed it is. But, so, you know, my question to myself was, have humans ever experienced this kind of thing before? And, you know, I'm versed in archaeology and paleontology and stuff like that. So, you know, I said, yeah, you know, right here in North America, after the last glacial maximum, sometime, you know, human beings started to show up here. And you know, they were stuck up in Beringia, an ice tree that came over, of course, from Asia. And they were hanging out there at least 15,000 years ago, maybe before. And they couldn't get south because the continental ice sheet all the way across, you know, the Laurentian, the Western Cordillera, you know, was complete. There was no ice-free corridor. The glacial ice went out way out on the coast. You couldn't really get up the coast, no place to land, icebergs, all that kind of stuff. So it kept people from coming down here. But then, you know, the best science says about 14.7 thousand years ago, things started to warm up. Those icebergs started to melt and calve off into the sea. The glaciers started to recede. The oceans that at that time were probably like, I don't know. It seemed to me that it'd be like 180 feet or something. Anyway, I forget how many, but a couple hundred feet, you know, lower started to rise, of course, and eventually the ice-free corridor opened, and people from Alaska walked down to probably Montana. Now, there's a lot of controversy in this stuff, so I'm not giving you the total gospel here, but, you know, the only way humans didn't have, there was a human presence down here. It's just called pre-Clovis. But so there were people down here before the corridor opened up, but not very many of them. And what they left behind are little indescript weapons. There's not any evidence whatsoever that they thrived or made an impact on the animals or the environment. You know, they're just hanging on with the tiniest toehold in a landscape, you think, so resplendent with big game and other things that, you know, how could you not? Well, there's reasons for that. But anyway, at that time, you know, that's very late Pleistocene then, and we still had mammoths and mastodons and, you know, saber-toothed tigers and cheetahs and African-type lions, but twice as big, that ran in pack, and a gigantic bear called a short-faced bear that weighed in at least twice as big as a grizzly, okay? Big sucker, a pure carnivore. And so, you know, people in the Arctic, to get through winter, they got to be big game hunters. You know, you just can't make it any other way. And so the people that came down here from Alaska when it first opened up, you know, were big game hunters. And at that time, there didn't have to be any mammoth in Alaska. You know, these are people that roamed around Alaska, and they knew there were mammoths in the world because their ancestors told, you know, their elders told stories around the campfire, and they could find the skeletons. You know, they even made tools out of the ivory, but they didn't run into one until they got down south. Maybe, say, in Alberta, you know, coming down the ice free corridor that basically is the Rocky Mountain front, down south into Montana, up in Blackfeet country. So they saw these mammoths, and, you know, they heard about them, but they didn't know what the hell they were, and they wanted to eat one, but their weapons were too puny. And so, you know, when they reached the first big lithic quarries, which is the kind of stuff you make an arrowhead out of, they had already crossed into Montana. Here comes, you know, the first great American invention. It's called the Clovis Point. And Clovis Point is a big, you know, maybe 6-inch long spearhead with a groove down both sides. It's been found, you know, amid the bones and in the bones of mammoths and mastodons all over America, especially in southeastern Arizona. There's a whole bunch of, you know, they found a mammoth skeleton down at Naco, close to the border there. You know, it was peppered, you know, peppered with Clovis points, and it looked like one that got away. But anyway, so they hunted these animals. And all the time the weather's heating up. And, you know, the big herd animals were, because of their own global warming, everything was moving around. Habitats were being fragmented. Animals are going extinct like they are today, but not nearly as fast as they are today, but enough for us to lose all those magnificent animals. And probably the reason they didn't get down here sooner, besides because there's some evidence that ice-free corridor was open for a few hundred years before humans actually used it, is down south there was a gigantic short-faced bear. And the gigantic short-faced bear is a meat eater all the way. And, you know, the best paleontological evidence probably points to being mostly scavenger. But whether it was a scavenger or a predator, it could certainly, you know, it's just like grizzly bears are occasionally predaceous, you know. But this one was a carnivore, and it specialized, I think, in acquiring kills of other animals, including Clovis hunters. So you go out and you kill a mammoth or something, there's going to be short-faced bear on it within, you know, hours. These are guys that stand 15 feet tall, and they can probably scent a carcass from 20 miles away. Well, anyway, somehow I believe the short-faced bear had to be thinning out with global warming, along with all of the other great megafauna of the Pleistocene, and that's how they came to establish, Native Americans came to establish themselves in the New World. And I picked that subject to write about, not because of my scientific interest in all of this, but, you know, thinking about that stuff was what an adventure for a guy like me. I mean, you know, the first people to, you know, somehow slide across the Bering Strait and stand on a ridge somewhere in Alaska and look south. I mean, they're looking at a wilderness 5 times the size of Australia. Not a human footprint, not a smoke, not a fire on the horizon. And it's teeming with these incredible wild animals, you know, including a couple dangerous predators that they'd never seen before, and they had to adapt all of that and live in that. I found that a lot of fun to think about because, you know, that adventure and exploration really punctuated my own life with lots of high points. And the book is there for anybody to read, but maybe the last lesson to learn about extinction at the end of the book is that, you know, I found that iconic invention called the Clovis Spear Point to be, you know, it was a beautiful, deadly weapon, as sleek and beautiful as a Patriot missile, you know, the first of its line. And, you know, that deadly duel is, which is climate change, or in this case, global warming, and human activity, in that case it was human activity, hunting activity, you know, is a timeless, ancient, but, you know, deadly blueprint for extinction then and today. And that's exactly what's happening up in Yellowstone Park today with the grizzlies.
Well, thank you for that synopsis. Our time is drawing to a close. Mike and I look forward to visiting with you in Tucson in a couple of weeks, if all goes according to plan. Thanks very much, Doug Peacock, for joining us today on Nature Bass Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks, Doug.
Hey, pleasure. You guys are heroes. See ya.
Thank you.
Okay,
you got a climate update?
I have a little update. A paper in the February 1st, 2016 issue of the Journal of Geophysical Research, Biogeosciences, finally indicates the scientific literature is catching up with the reality of the dire situation with respect to Arctic permafrost. The bottom line from the abstract reads, quote, "Our results suggest that the subarctic tundra ecosystem is shifting away from its historical function as a carbon sink to a carbon source." I've added this tidbit to feedback number 13. The referee journal literature tackles the topic of hothouse Earth with a paper in the February 9th, 2016 issue of Nature Communications. I'll quote extensively from the abstract. Quote, "Water-rich planets such as Earth are expected to become eventually uninhabitable because liquid water turns unstable at the surface as temperatures increase with solar luminosity. Whether a large increase of atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases such as CO2 could also destroy the habitability of water-rich planets has remained unclear. Here we show with three-dimensional aquaplanet simulations that CO2-induced forcing as readily destabilizes the climate as does solar forcing. The climate instability is caused by a positive cloud feedback and leads to a new steady state with global mean sea surface temperatures above 330K. End quote. 330 Kelvin is about 57 degrees Celsius compared to today's temperature about 15 degrees Celsius. And all this happens, of course, faster than expected.
Yeah, need some cooling fans.
As another indication of the conservatism of the scientific process, the delay in sea level rise resulting from land soaking up the extra precipitation associated with global average rise in temperature has not been previously studied or acknowledged in major assessments. According to a paper in the February 11th, 2016 issue of Science, quote, "Between 2002 and 2014, climate variability resulted in an additional 3,200 plus or minus 900 gigatons of water being stored on land, slowing the rate of sea level rise by 0.71 plus or minus 0.2 milliliters per year," end quote. For the first time, researchers have documented algae-related toxins in Arctic sea mammals. Specifically, toxins produced by harmful algal blooms are showing up in Alaska marine mammals as far north as the Arctic Ocean, much farther north than reported previously, according to a paper in the February 11th, 2016 issue of Harmful Algae. Yes, there's really a journal with that name.
Yeah.
Oddly, there's no journal called Harmful Patriarchs.
Hey, there's our niche.
Yes, but we digress. The abstract indicates, quote, "In this study, 905 marine mammals from 13 species were sampled. Demoic acid was detected in all 13 species examined and had the greatest prevalence in bowhead whales and harbor seals. Saxitoxin was detected in 10 of the 13 species. These results provide evidence that toxins are present throughout Alaska waters at levels high enough to be detected in marine mammals and have the potential to impact marine mammal health in the Arctic marine environment," end quote. I've added this information to feedback number 23. If we represented the mainstream media, I'd go on to say that there's no evidence of any threat to human health. Yes, we're mammals. And yes, we rely on the same web of life as other mammals. But we're clever. I'm sure we'll be fine. Researchers compared drought predictions for the second half of the 21st century with reconstructions of drought conditions dating back to the 11th century and found that the central plains in southwest U.S. could experience the driest conditions in nearly a millennium. The results were published February 12, 2016 in Science Advances. The abstract concludes, quote, "Notably, future drought risk will likely exceed even the driest centuries of the medieval climate anomaly, 1100 to 1300, on both moderate and high future emission scenarios, leading to drought conditions without precedent during the last millennium." So,
the medieval climate anomaly.
Yeah.
The old MCA.
Yeah, not everybody talks with that sort of language, right? Do they? I'm reminded when I go on this show that I say stuff sort of off the cuff that nobody actually hears off the cuff.
Drop that at a cocktail party. Medieval climate anomaly. Of course.
You go to cocktail parties still?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's it. That wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions or topics you'd like us to address in the show. And please share the link everywhere. We'd like our numbers to go up. Hey.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. Please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. You can find my work every Sunday at the Good Men Project if you just search my name. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be taking your calls, responding to your comments and questions. It's a call-in show, and it's a show that's really about the listeners. So we need the listeners to jump on it. Otherwise, you'll have to listen to our boring banter. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or on Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to Doug Peacock for joining us and to AfriZen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture isn't very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Da-da-da.